From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I will miss them after the last hummingbird passes through the garden sometime in September, continuing its long trip southward, with me as just one pit stop on the way. They're the most obvious sign this time of year at my place of the biological phenomenon of avian migration, a subject that, though I've witnessed for decades, I admit I really don't know much about. In January, I read about a newly published paper about bird migration by scientists at Cornell Lab of Ornithology, brought to life with an exciting, almost hypnotizing animated map they'd created, illustrating both the spring and fall routes of 118 bird species in the Western Hemisphere. My guest today, Frank Lasorte, is a research associate and ecologist at the Lab of O, and was a key part of that research, and I'm excited at the chance to learn more about migration from him, so welcome to the program. Frank, how are you?
I'm good.
Good to speak to you. It's that time of year again, isn't it?
It certainly is.
they're moving.
Yeah, I can see that out my window right now.
Oh, really? Who's moving by?
Some goldfinches.
Oh, okay. So I guess first, I wonder if we can at least briefly define what migration is, since different species of birds move different distances or not at all, very little. Can you tell us a little bit sort of what's migration?
So it's actually a very diverse phenomenon. You have a broad range of strategies that birds use, from very short migration to extremely long migration. You have species whose populations all migrate, and you have species who have populations that some migrate and some do not migrate.
Oh.
Partial migration. So it's actually a very diverse, complex phenomenon with lots of different variation among species.
Because people think, like, oh, bluebirds, I don't see the bluebirds in the winter, but in fact, they're not in the tropics, right? I mean, so would they be a partial migrant, is that?
Right, so some species just move to regions where they can still find food.
Yeah.
Or others are committed to long-distance movements to the tropics, where they have very specific wintering grounds.
So why do they migrate? I mean, it seems like it's a great risk. I mean, literally life and limb, yeah? Why do they do it? What is it for food, what you just said?
It's for food. So you have this pulse of resources in the temperate regions.
Yeah.
And that occurs in the summertime. And the thing is, the birds that live here year-round, they can't necessarily take advantage of all those resources.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these species that have evolved this capacity to move their populations north into these regions where there's abundant insects and few competitors, and they can raise young fairly effectively, and then when they're done, they just go back south. So in many ways, these species just spend a few weeks on the breeding grounds, so they're really just visiting this area to take advantage of the resources, raise their young, and then move back south to their wintering grounds where they tend to spend most of the year.
And how do they know? And I know this isn't—it's not a universal answer, probably because different species maybe have different cues. But how do they know when to go? Is it, you know—is there day length, temperature, food's running out? I mean, what are the triggers?
Right. So birds that winter in the tropics, there really aren't that many triggers. the environment's really consistent across the year.
Right.
So in that case, they have to rely on internal cues often, and those internal cues tend to be fairly rigid. So they leave at a very specific time, and they make their way north and arrive typically at a very specific time. So there's a little flexibility for those guys.
Mm-hmm.
But when they come back south, now there's changes in daylight, changes in temperature that occur at higher latitudes that are very obvious and provide strong cues, especially as the insect population starts to decline.
So there's multiple cues, and it's more urgent, I guess, to leave at the right time when you're heading south, yeah?
Right. Some species, they're very flexible in terms of their ability to use resources. So some species will feed on insects during the summertime, but then switch to seeds and fruit in the autumn to sort of extend their stay a little bit and build up their body fat,
Mm-hmm.
enough energy to make the southward journey.
So how about a couple of examples? As an expert in this biological phenomenon, birds that really impress you with either the distance, like who are some of the longest distance migrants,
right,
for instance?
Well, for the ones we study in the Western Hemisphere, one that's always been very interesting is the black pole warbler.
Uh-huh.
And they breed up through the boreal forest in Canada. Mm-hmm. And what they do is migrate east to the Atlantic coastline in New England, and then they, and this is in the autumn, they leave the coastline, fly across the Atlantic Ocean, straight down to South America.
Wow.
And it's one of the longest migratory flights for the warbler species in the Western Hemisphere. And only recently have we gotten enough evidence to really establish that these species are flying out over the Atlantic in the autumn. Before, there was thought that they would funnel along the coastline and down through Florida, but in fact, they're largely going over the ocean.
Again, it seems like risky business, but they must be doing something right, yeah?
Right. Well, if in the autumn, it's a more direct route, going directly south over the Atlantic to South America. If you look at the globe, it's actually, it saves you a lot of time.
So the black poll warbler is impressive, and it's right. Some birds that don't go as far, that are migrants but don't go as far, like do some birds just go to Florida or to northern Central America, for instance?
Or? Right, right. So there's many that do that.
Mm-hmm.
In the Caribbean, Central America.
Mm-hmm.
And those present very interesting case studies because they're going from very large breeding areas encompassing large portions of North America, and then wintering in very confined areas on islands or within Central America.
Huh. That's a drastic, two different, completely different environments. Yeah,
right.
Different parts of their lives.
Right. Huh. So they occur often in high densities on the wintering grounds. So that's one reason we're concerned about habitat loss in those areas, because you have high densities of high numbers of species, so loss of habitat will impact more individuals and more species.
So when you undertook, and I want to get into the most recent paper that I read, the one I mentioned in the introduction that I had read in January when it was published, what kind of got you asking the questions that became the study in the first place? And tell us what you were proposing to find out when you began this latest. I know it's ongoing research from, that you've been building upon through your career.
So it's very challenging documenting migration for birds because they move such long distances, and this often occurs at night at high altitudes. So to observe this phenomenon has been something that only recently we've been able to do effectively. And usually this involves banding the birds with some kind of tracking device.
Mm-hmm.
But here we're taking advantage of a new data source, eBird, which is an online citizen science database where birdwatchers enter their observations. And we've compiled enough observations for a number of species that we can document where they are across the entire year. So piecing together millions of observations across the Western Hemisphere, we can say the population is likely here during this day, and then it moves here, then here. And we can piece it all together into a giant map that shows where they occur across the year. And one interesting thing that was the focus of that study was that the birds don't necessarily follow the same general path in the spring and the autumn. Many species tend to follow a looped path.
Oh.
And these loops can be quite large, especially for species in the eastern portion of North America. Because what happens is in the spring, they come up usually over the Gulf of Mexico and then up through the continent. And then in the autumn, they tend to fly more to the east and often over the Atlantic Ocean back south. So the black pole warbler is a good example of a species that does that. So in the spring, you have strong winds blowing north over the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay.
And they likely latch onto those winds and get pushed north. But in the autumn, those winds are gone, but still the winds are primarily from the south, and it's much more efficient to go directly south over the Atlantic back to the wintering grounds.
So the paths are often loops, but they're not the same loops in spring and fall. It's not like they say, oh, I'm going to the same route. Like if I'm going to my sister's house, I take the same route every time.
Right.
It's not like that.
No, yeah. So it's and there's a lot of diversity too in the shape and width of those loops. And it's likely related primarily to wind. Now, wind plays a big role in the amount of energy they have to consume.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can get a tailwind, that can boost their migration speed tremendously. So a lot of these broad-scale migration patterns are defined by seasonal patterns of wind and how they change across large regions of North America and South America.
Do birds, when they're going to start the journey north to the breeding grounds, for that short time that they're going to be in the north, do they kind of stoke up on food in the same way that they seem to do on the way south when they're getting ready to head south?
Right. Yeah, so there's increasing evidence that these birds have stopover sites in South America.
Oh.
Where they'll stop for a week and feed intensively and then make the long jump over the Gulf of Mexico and up into their breeding grounds. But the research in South America has been more sparse. Now, most of the research has been in the United States and Europe, and research within the tropics has been less intensive. So a lot of these questions are still not that well addressed.
Huh. Is one direction, north or south, easier and harder? Is it always harder going in one direction or the other? Or
it's generally harder going south, just because of the prevailing winds.
Okay, I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
So getting down there at the end of the summer, and I guess I should ask, I mean, maybe I should have even backtracked and said, we have a number of flyways, as I always heard of them talked about as flyways, and I don't know if that's exactly what I'm seeing on those maps, kind of, is these patterns of birds moving down or up
right.
the continent. These general areas where that birds use to travel, yes?
Right, so we've looked at flyways as well. That's an old concept. It's been
yeah, that's for, what I thought. That's why,
yeah. Years. Yeah. And it was originally designed for waterfowl. So waterfowl were relatively easy to track 100 years ago.
Ah, but, big birds.
Right, so the big birds, they often migrate during the day at low altitudes.
Honking, quacking,
right,
whatever.
Exactly. So the original flyway concept was designed for waterfowl.
Oh.
And recently we're trying to shift those flyways to consider terrestrial birds, like warblers or thrushes.
Right.
And those do show up in some of our research, and they tend to be broader than what you see with waterfowl. Waterfowl, of course, have to follow Mississippi River or other features.
Mm-hmm.
Where terrestrial birds, they can migrate across broad fronts.
I see. Okay.
And so the flyways for terrestrial species tend to be much larger.
Okay, because I knew it was a word that I had in my head from being interested in birds for many decades. Mm-hmm. You know, as a hobbyist kind of person. But I was thinking, gosh, you know, it didn't say that anywhere in the research. I don't believe it said that. So you're right, it's an outdated. It's kind of an older concept.
Right.
We're
trying to actually remold it to consider the new information.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's still probably a useful concept, but it has to be placed within sort of a modern context now.
Right. So on these animated maps, I guess there are two maps. One, there are just dots, and one, there are numbers, each mm-hmm. number representing a different species among the 118 species, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And so describe, if we can you help us paint a visual picture, and obviously I'll show the maps and the transcript of the show, but of what you were seeing, and how did you even get that idea to make that map?
It was a couple years in the making.
Yeah.
The thing with the eBird data, there's so much data, and it's easy to get lost in it. And the goal here is try to summarize all that information into a very sort of conceptually simple framework for interpreting patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually we just settled in, well, let's just do a dot for each day. We'll do a single dot for each day. They'll summarize the overall pattern. And if you connect all those dots together, you'll get a general trajectory or pathway where
right.
the population is moving. And we tried it out, and it was very effective, and it was easy to interpret, and allowed us to look at these very broad-scale patterns, which haven't really been looked at this level of detail before.
Mm-hmm.
Up until now, it's usually you radio tag a handful of birds, and you
right.
can call where those birds go. Often there'll be mortality events, and you'll lose data,
yeah.
or other things will happen, and often you have very, very limited information. But here we have really comprehensive information on where the population is, essentially. Each day of the year.
Because you're using eBird. Like, so for instance, for years I put my observations, minimal as they are, into eBird.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was driving here to the studio today to talk to you, I saw probably 100 swallows on the wire by a big farm field just down the road from my house. And the last few weeks I've seen hundreds of swallows at a time. And if I had been recording those, saying what species they were, and putting them in my eBird and giving the location, that's the kind of thing that you would have been, not literally that observation, but that's the kinds of the movements, yeah?
Right, right. So all so all the information, so thousands of observations, go into generating the summaries.
Yeah.
And so throw any eBird observations out. Each observation is important.
Yeah.
It sort of fits a much larger puzzle, and helps me piece together these very general summaries.
Yeah. So, and sometimes also when birds, at the beginning we were talking a little bit about birds that do and don't move or move different distances and are not migrants to the tropics every mm-hmm. year. Sometimes, I mean, to me that's interesting. I don't know if, I love sometimes when I do see birds that I don't expect to see when I see them in the winter, kind of wondering about that. Were those types of, this was strictly about the longer distance migrants?
Right.
This work? Yeah.
Yeah, so this study, we focused on species that migrated at least 2,000 kilometers.
2,000, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we wanted to encompass the full hemisphere and look at the more extreme distance migrants.
Right. Do the roots have wiggle room, like from year to year? Like, can they decide, to go off course, quote unquote, a little bit?
So we actually have another study where we're looking at that question, and it's a very important question because how much flexibility do these birds have when they migrate in terms of their behavior? And as the environment changes, are they going to be able to adapt during migration?
Right, because what if there's a tropical storm coming or a hurricane? I guess it's been upgraded to right now, right?
Right.
And so I'm migrating. What do I do now?
Right. So what we're finding is that species that migrate longer distances tend to be more flexible.
Okay.
When they're migrating, which makes a lot of sense. If you have to migrate a long distance, it makes sense to when you're on that journey to look for conditions that are more favorable as you move north or move south and try to take advantage of those conditions the best you can. Where if you're a short-distance migrant, there really isn't a strong pressure to move quickly.
Right.
And you tend to be less selective and just move south.
Mm-hmm.
Typical pattern.
Mm-hmm. I think I read a study that maybe you collaborated with a colleague at Stony Brook. Was it Stony Brook University, I think,
mm-hmm.
That cited hummingbird migration, I think,
right.
And talked about wiggle room and so forth, yes?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so hummingbirds are a unique case.
In all ways, they're unique, aren't
ways.
They?
Right, yeah. So their migration is difficult to observe. So just sort of basic natural history of their migration is not that well understood. And we sort of assume that they migrate at lower altitudes, possibly just above the tree line. And when you see them fly, they can fly very quickly.
Yeah.
But they have to, they need a lot of resources to maintain that energy level. And how they do that is not really that well understood. But we looked at it using eBird data, and we documented some very broad-scale patterns of movement. And we also see the loop trajectories for those guys as well.
Oh, okay. And are they some of the birds that, in terms of, I asked you ones that stand out, and you said the black pole warbler. To the hummingbirds, are they sort of heroes of migration? Because, I don't know how you get a tiny little body like that. How far do they go? They go very far, yes?
Mm-hmm.
To Costa Rica, to
Right. Somewhere
like that, yeah?
Right, right. Yeah, it's something that we're actively studying.
Mm-hmm.
And a key question is exactly how do they time their migration to be able to find resources to keep up their energy levels?
Right.
And and exactly how they're doing that is not really clear. But many of these species we studied are in the western North America. We have mountains and a lot of heterogeneity
uh-huh.
in environments. And some of our work indicates that they're actually taking advantage of these elevational gradients. So as plants flower, that'll move up in elevation.
Right.
And they're likely tracking that gradient as it develops in the spring and into the summer. So they're able to get resources all year round by just following the gradient of flowering plants.
How far does a bird, in terms of sort of heroic acts, how far do certain species that impress you particularly go at a clip, without resting or do we know that?
So I don't study the individual birds, so I can't say for a particular species, but
uh-huh.
at the level we look at it, which is the population level, there's several species that migrate very quickly, and there's evidence that often in the spring when they cross the Gulf, if they still have time, they just keep going north. and will go up into the Appalachians before they actually stop.
Right.
So they build up large energy reserves, and I think they're willing to use up all that energy to make a very dramatic movement to cross some of these large barriers.
Hmm.
And the migration speeds we're documenting at the population level are very dramatic. Individual level, which we don't study, I think if the birds can get a strong tailwind, the speeds can be very dramatic as well.
Hmm. In the last few minutes, we have maybe 3 minutes, and I wanted to ask you, so why does it matter that we humans understand migration better? I mean, obviously, you don't just do this work, you know, academically for the pure.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do with deeper insight into bird migration?
Yeah, the big theme of a lot of our work is that we want to be able to look at migration across the full year.
Uh-huh.
So often when you talk about birds and some of the challenges they're facing, you just focus on the breeding season because that's where we have most of the information,
mm-hmm.
on the breeding grounds in North America. But the reality is they only spend a few weeks here, and they spend much more time on the wintering grounds, and they spend time on migration. But what's actually happening in those areas is less well understood. So once we can sort of get a full annual cycle picture of what's going on, we can sort of pinpoint the areas where the threats are likely to be greatest, and we can focus our limited conservation resources at those locations to help maintain their populations.
Right. So it would help us with conservation,
exactly.
With focus of our conservation efforts. Okay,
exactly.
That makes sense. You just said they spend most of their time or a majority of their time in the in the wintering grounds, a minority in the breeding grounds. They spend a lot of time migrating. How long is a trip? Are there, like, records? are there some birds that get from to where they're going fast? Or, I mean, is it weeks?
So species that migrate the longest tend to travel very quickly.
Uh-huh.
So species that winter in southern South America, they'll travel to their breeding grounds in North America very quickly over a period of a couple weeks.
Uh-huh.
And often, if the breeding grounds are up near the Arctic Circle, they'll just stay there for a very brief period of time and then start heading back south.
Wow.
So it's and there's a lot of variation on that pattern. And so each species has their own unique resources they need to time the migration to coincide with. And they have their own unique patterns of courtship and breeding.
Mm.
They have to fit into that limited window.
Mm.
And it's a remarkable diversity of strategies. And the more we study it, the more we see that there really isn't a lot of similarity. Now, we can make some generalizations in terms of some species are doing this in this region. But overall, there's a lot of variation.
And
it's remarkable that they've evolved to capture all of these unique strategies that help them maintain their populations from 1 year to the next.
Well, it's remarkable, and what's remarkable is the work that you and your colleagues are doing there. I can't wait to show people the maps who haven't seen them and to, encourage people to read this research. And I'm excited to see what you're going to come up with next, what insights you're going to share with us next. Thank you so much, Frank, from Cornell. It's so good to speak to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. And it's so good to speak to all the rest of you as well. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening and birding meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.